Welcome once again into the Soccer OG. Hey, that's me, Max Bretos, episode 199. As always, a reminder to rate, review, download, subscribe, and tell a friend about our wonderful podcast here, being listened to all over the planet in every port of call. Check out the Soccer OG on YouTube under my name, Max Bretos. New videos being put out there all the time, and you get to see my pretty face. We have a cracking show. We just wrapped up the Champions League semifinals, so we are going to talk about it in detail, the good, the bad, the ugly, with regards to Real Madrid, as well as Borussia Dortmund making the final on June the 1st, all the controversy that we saw in the Real Madrid game, and it's not a one-man job. So joining me, Kyle Bond, who is with the Sporting News, who covers the sport here in the United States, but has a landscape, including in Europe, where he has to keep a diligent eye on. He'll be joining me, but we will also talk U.S. men's national team. Kyle recently had an interview with USMNT defender Chris Richards. We'll get his thoughts about how he is progressing as a professional. And we'll also talk about the big questions for the United States heading into a huge summer. Some big calls that have to be made at fullback, at striker, at center back. We'll get into all those details. This is going to be a great show, fresh with the Champions League, so we'll get all the details for you ASAP. Let's get ready for the rundown. We're going to get into it here at the rundown, business end slash check complete. We're separating the conversations with Kyle Bond of the Sporting News. We're going to talk about the Champions League, and then we're going to have the next segment talking about the U.S. men's national team and circling around the fact that he was able to catch up with Chris Richards, the Crystal Palace defender, coming off his best performance in his professional career. Coming very soon, I'm going to rank the best performers of the European season for USMNT. That is coming to my YouTube page under my name, Max Preto. So check that out over the next couple days. It'll be there waiting for you, I promise. So the rundown here, we're going to talk about some things non-Champions League, non-USMNT. The U.S. Open Cup. The U.S. Open Cup is here. The club I work for, LAFC, are in Las Vegas. I was going to go out there. Got stuck with some logistics, so I'll be watching here from home. Watching the U.S. Open Cup is a little tricky. And you know, I'm a big believer in that competition. That's where I started my broadcasting career, calling the Sounders Charleston Battery game at RFK Stadium. First time I got to travel for a game. So the U.S. Open Cup, always near and dear to me. I will defend it at every stage. And I'm excited. I want LAFC to go out and win this tournament. And, you know, I've spoken to Steve Cherundolo and the players, and they're excited. You know, Ante Razov, who, you know, really boosted his career in the U.S. Open Cup. Some incredible performances. As a broadcaster, it's huge for me. As the players and the coaches, I know it's big. So we muscle through it. Now, I will say this, and it is abundantly clear, because trying to get the stream is difficult. There's no way to watch it on terrestrial television. The stadiums are all empty. Nobody cares. I care. Probably a lot of you care. Nobody cares. The only place people care is on Twitter. That is where, God bless those accounts that they're blowing it up and trying to get to salvage it. And I hope that it can be salvaged, but it's looking dire. There's no way to sugarcoat it. And some people say, let the USL teams that are there. There was a game, the big surprise, and they were saying the cup set and the magic of the open. There was no magic. It was a nice result for Detroit City. But to beat Houston Dynamo, which played with a pretty good team, it's a nice result. But if a USL team can win it, that would be great. But I'm not draped with magic when I come thinking about the Open Cup. If Detroit City hosted it, they would have probably attended it well in their smaller venue. And maybe that's a nice rule for the Open Cup to do. Some MLS teams are on the road. Some are playing at home. The majority are playing at home. And it's not resonating. And, you know, it's got beaten up a bit. I know it has. It's hard to get excited at this point. And I appreciate everyone getting excited about it, Twitter. But, man, it's not looking good. You know, this is a property nobody wants. You know, in this arms race where everyone's getting soccer properties, we're just not no one really wanted the Open Cup. And again, it hasn't been put in this beautiful wrapping paper, but it's hard. It's hard, man. And I know the clubs that are there are going to do their best. You know, I spoke to Peter Vermees. We did the Sporting Kansas City. He rested some of his players to be ready for the trip to Union Omaha in a game that I'm recording this tonight. It happens Wednesday. I spoke to Pablo Mastroeni and Real Salt Lake, and they're hyped to play New Mexico United. They want to win the trophy here. It's a great opportunity. But from one year to the next, and from a few years ago where the Open Cup was at a nice height, it is fallen. And we can blame a lot of people. I wish MLS could keep it on their platform, but I understand MLS prioritizing the League's Cup. The League's Cup has a higher ceiling than the Open Cup. The Open Cup, we've been going for a long time. It's just not resonating. The League's Cup, because of how the Liga MX teams are going to push it, and they're going to come out hot, I can tell you that. They didn't like last year. I talked to the media members. I spoke to Pablo Ramirez here a couple of weeks ago on the podcast. Folks in Mexico don't want a repeat of what happened. So that tournament's going to grow. So if you're a league, that's where you want to invest. If we're looking at the Open Cup, there's no one there. You can't find the streams. The streams aren't the best quality. And there it is. There it is. Interesting article from Sportico, and people got up in arms, where they listed the 50 most valuable soccer clubs in the world, and five MLS teams were in the top 20. Crazy, huh? Manchester United won, their value $6.2 billion. Real Madrid valued at $6 billion. Barcelona, Liverpool, Bayern Munich, all over about $4.8 billion. Man City 6th, PSG 7th. Then you go all the way down. All the clubs you would expect are there. And there you see LAFC, 15th, valued at $1.15 billion. Atlanta United, 17, over a billion. Inter Miami, over a billion. LA Galaxy, right at a billion. And New York City, number 20, just under $1 billion. Now, a lot of these clubs are that valued, LAFC, because they have a big chunk of real estate with that stadium in downtown. And that raises the value. And that'll continue to raise the value. But they also have some equity in that club, having won a championship and so forth. Inter Miami at 18, when they open Freedom Park with that big piece of real estate in that stadium, they're going to skyrocket, not to mention with the equity they're building up with Lionel Messi and stars coming there. So they could be close to, based on this, probably like 13 or 14 in a couple of years when that stadium's built. New York City FC's got that stadium in Queens going to get built. They're going to rocket up there. So this is not a evaluation of the players they have. I mean, this is a evaluation of everything. And the MLS teams are aided by the fact that they have, you know, stadiums and real estate behind these ownership groups, which is something to hang your hat on. And then from that point, you will see about the players and what they can do with how they resonate. But it's an interesting poll, I'm bringing it up to you because I don't think it's one of these things you roll your eyes and go, this can't be true. It can be true. Because also in Europe, there's a big drop-off from the big clubs. You know, after teams like Juventus and Dortmund and AC Milan, and keep in mind, the Serie A, their clubs, they play in old, dilapidated stadiums. And some of the infrastructure is not quite there. And that's where MLS has their strengths. So if they can get things on the playing field, etc., then all those clubs are going to move up. They're all going to move up. It's probably a scream also for MLS to, you know, loosen up the purse strings a bit, which I think they want to do. They're waiting for the right time. And, you know, they're getting pressure from FIFA and Gianni Infantino. And the one expression, I can't even say it, because if I hear it one more time, I'm going to scream. But I'm going to say it when they take the training wheels off. No one can use that. Stop using that expression. It's absurd. MLS has had the training wheels off for some time. Whether you want to admit it or not, they have put together an incredible product that is thriving. With their broadcast deal, with their stadiums, with their ownership groups. And that is only going to continue. They have an incredible new ownership group coming up in San Diego. So have you paid attention to what they are doing with their residency program? And I'm sure partnerships with clubs across the border, because they're going to be the gateway to Mexico. Yeah, this is all good. I mean, we understand that there's some people out there that may criticize MLS at every corner, and MLS deserves some criticism, but not at every corner. They're doing a lot of things right, and this is going to show with these valuations, but it's all moving in that right direction. On the ultimate growth of MLS, where they can be considered a club, their clubs could be considered on a similar playing field as the teams in the top 10 here. I mean, that's not going to happen anytime soon, but it's going to start getting closer. So, an interesting poll. The Open Cup, I'll be watching tonight. To watch some Open Cup. I know there's a lot of you that sat here and screamed at people and screamed at MLS about the Open Cup and are not watching it. So your vote, your comments don't matter. I mean, if you're outraged by it, you've got to go to a game or at least watch it. I'm going to end up going to a couple games, mostly LAFC games if they advance, but I'll go to some other games because that's what I do. It's like, care. I love our sport. We all got to chip in. Stop just yapping and stop talking the talk. Walk the walk, baby. Okay, we have a fantastic show. We got to get into this Champions League stuff. It was absolutely breathtaking, for better or worse. Kyle Bond of the Sporting News joins me in the business end to talk the Champions League. Stick around afterwards for Check Complete. We'll break down his conversation with Chris Richards. We'll talk about the USMNT and the big decisions for Greg Berhalter coming this summer ahead of Copa America, which is just weeks away. This is the Soccer OG. We're back here in the business, and it's going to be a busy one. We're going to try and cover as much ground as possible, because when I reached out to Kyle Bond of the Sporting News, who has a great article about Chris Richards, he spoke to Chris Richards. That was the light bulb. And then Kyle is immersed in the Champions League. I said, well, we got to talk about these semifinals. But never in my wildest dreams did I think we would have as much meat on this bone as we certainly have. Kyle, are you ready for this? Because we're gonna have to try and be very, very thorough.
I know. I feel like I just pulled an all-nighter just watching the game, and now we have to break it down. So let's go while we still got the adrenaline pumping.
Well, that's what I'm doing. We're actually recording this. The game ended about an hour ago, so things may happen afterwards that we may not take into consideration. But I love doing it this way, so you can. It's visceral and it's fresh in your memory. And we get into this, and now we'll talk about the Champions League final and obviously what Borussia Dortmund did, which actually a penny for your thought on that stuff, because with Borussia Dortmund, to me, it is a situation which tells me that the Champions League, I mean, what we've seen the last 2 days tells you that this competition is going to look very different. We know it's going to expand, but the Borussia Dortmund run, and I looked at that roster, Kyle, I'm hard-pressed. I think of Tottenham Hotspur in 2019. There was a Monaco run in 2006 or 2004. Some teams that you wouldn't expect making a final. And the reason you kind of give some pause on that is because it's Borussia Dortmund. But if you look at this roster, this is not a Champions League final roster. This is a fifth-place team. They sell their stars, Erling Haaland, Jude Bellingham, one after another. They had a massive meltdown at the end of last year. I don't think I didn't see this coming. I thought they were going to finish last in their group. Lo and behold, they're preparing for the showpiece event at Wembley.
Yeah, well, so if we go all the way back to that group stage, we did predictions for each group before the group stage started. And if you took my prediction and flipped it upside down, that was how the actual group stage finished. So
I think I might have been very close to that as well.
I was completely wrong on all accounts there. But, you know, there are two sides to the coin for Borussia Dortmund this year. First is Edin Terzic has done a fabulous job with this team. And you saw it in that second leg against PSG, where they did not sit back and defend really until they got their second goal. And then they really sat back and defended. But until then, they went at PSG on the road against a team that was heavily expected to win and advance. And I think some credit goes to the away goals rule, because if that away goals rule was in place, you know, they sit back and really try to counter. But the way that they attacked that game and approached that game was fabulous. And I was really impressed. At halftime, 0-0, I said, I think I put it out there on social media. I said, I don't know if Dortmund's going to win this game or not, but you really have to praise how they've approached this game. Now, flip that to the other side. They are the luckiest team in the Champions League this year, and I don't mean that just on the eye test, but statistically. Going into that second leg against PSG, Dortmund had the highest XG to goals differential of any club in the Champions League of over 10. They had conceded 10 more XG than actual goals. So Gregor Kobel has been fantastic in goal. He's been the best goalkeeper in the Bundesliga, and he's the best goalkeeper in the Champions League. But there's a lot of luck involved there. And that's okay. That doesn't mean that they're not deserving of reaching here, but it is important to acknowledge, and it may play a factor in the final because Real Madrid won't let them get away with chances like PSG did.
June the 1st at Wembley, it's a one-off. So I think Borussia Dortmund has a chance because of that. I don't think they'd have any chance. It was home and away. But they're going to face this Real Madrid team who, I guess to no one's surprise, found a way to pull it off there with two late goals. The question, we're going to talk about a few big ticket items here with VAR, the lack of VAR on a call that I think most people believe that Bayern Munich should have been able to force extra time. Who knows what would have come of that. We'll talk about those two big things because there's two very important developments with regards to that. Certainly moving forward, these things are going to be under the microscope. I think that Polish crew is going to be under the microscope. And that's one of the top crews in UEFA, which certainly applies to being one of the best crews on the planet right now. I want to talk about, you know, obviously, this incredible goal by Alphonso Davies. Coming into this game, Kyle, I've never been a huge Thomas Tuchel fan. I was so critical of him, how he handled Christian Pulisic. In hindsight, I was probably a little overboard about that. The guy's amazing. And he was going to go take a team. He was some 10, 15 minutes away. Third different Champions League team, a third different club from three different countries to a Champions League final in 5 years. And then instead of celebrating Thomas Tuchel, which I was ready to do because he hit all the right buttons, this guy's got, I mean, this is going to be a tricky few days for him. A, because they blow the lead. B, because they did nothing to control Vinicius, who was going over Kimmich. They brought in De Ligt a bit, but I think there was maybe a different alternative. The substitutions were weird. Harry
to
Kane,
say the least.
I know, but Harry Kane comes out and someone says he might have been injured, but it was still a bit odd. And on the flip side, Carlo Ancelotti hit all the right buttons. And I'm not taking anything from Carlo Ancelotti, but I thought this would be a crowning moment for Thomas Tuchel. Instead, lots of questions.
Yeah, I actually wasn't a huge fan of how Carlo Ancelotti played this game. I thought the first half they were clearly the better team, but I didn't love taking off Rodrigo. He was really good. He had been, you know, only kept out by two unreal Neuer saves. And he brought in Brahim Diaz, who didn't really do anything. But then, you know, on the flip side, you're right. Tuchel, I mean, taking off Harry Kane makes no sense. You are one Real Madrid goal with 7 minutes plus stoppage time to go away from extra time and possible penalties. And you're going to take off one of the best penalty takers in the world and one of the best goal scorers. Full stop in the world. It makes no sense. And it's not like he brought on an extra defender. He brought on Choupo-Moting, who's another striker. Like, that makes no sense. So there's questionable decisions from both sides. But, I mean, there's so much to break down here just from the final few minutes. Husselu, what a goal merchant. He's been an unreal signing. He is on loan at Real Madrid from Espanyol, who got relegated last year and are in the second division. So the guy who just scored a brace to send Real Madrid to the Champions League final is technically on loan from a second division club. That's nuts.
the thing about Real Madrid, we view them as such this powerful entity, and they have the biggest stars on the world in that starting 11 when it comes from Bellingham and Rodrigo and Vinicius. Valverde, Camavinga, I think he'd put in there. He came off the bench. Luka Modric's a little bit past his prime. It's a good bench. It's not the Galacticos type bench. Although that said, for them to get those contributions that they were able to do, in particular from Joselu, which was is a big issue for Real Madrid. They say they don't have a striker, and this is part of the reason they're going after Kylian Mbappe. This has got there's a hole there that he is going to fill, and for that to change with this incredible double that he is able to score. For again, he's a good. He's way past his prime. He is. He's not athletic, or he's a poacher, and man, that came in handy. But I think this Real Madrid bench doesn't blow you away, yet it made all the difference.
Yeah, and what's funny about, let's talk about Real Madrid and the transfer window this year, because it's possible that they could sign Kylian Mbappe and Alphonso Davies, who had an absolute thunderbolt. And I think what we saw today from Davies confirms what we already knew, which is he's not a left back. And he will play at left back when they need him to, and he's improved greatly defending, but he's not a left back. He's not the best defender in the world. He never will be. He's a much better left winger. He's plays left wing for Canada and is awesome. And he was outstanding today coming on for, I think, Serge Gnabry, who got hurt. Yeah, he's had
very early
with injuries. But he was awesome. And Real Madrid may end up, right now they play a 4-4-2, kind of. It's 4-4-2 diamond with Vinicius and Rodrigo up front, neither of whom are natural number nines. They both play as sort of like inside forwards, if you will. And then the midfielders get forward on runs. So it's like, there's just no true number nine. Now you're going to add potentially Mbappe, who's basically the exact same player as Vinicius, and Davies, who's a left winger also. So, like, what are they going to do with these guys? I don't know what they're going to do with them, but I guess we'll find out. It's just funny how, like, Davies scores a goal against Real Madrid, and he might join them. And then now you've got Mbappe, who, is out of the Champions League. I mean, there's so much to talk about here, but I am very curious to see how that all works out next year, because it doesn't look like there's room for any of them.
Yeah, Kylian Mbappe, they're playing him centrally at PSG. Well, they played him out wide against Dortmund in the second leg, and they moved him centrally, and I thought it was a little better. And Barcola came in there, and it was nice. But I don't think Mbappe is comfortable in that central channel. And to your point, you have a lot of great wide players, but I get the feeling that's going to be – you're going to get managers that are going to find a way to defend that and take away that space, which is going to be problematic. And I get it. You want to be a place where you have the best players in the world, and Mbappe and Alphonso Davies certainly amongst the best at their position. Mbappe certainly one of the best, if not the best player on the planet right now. It's very curious. But by the way, that Alphonso Davies goal, completely set up by Harry Kane, who was in that center channel and then lobs his ball in where Davies had a lot of work to do, but he just seamlessly came right into it, turned on the ball and finished it. And at that point, I don't think we gave it to Bayern Munich, but man, they gave it a real run. You got the feeling that they were getting closer and closer, but then the goal came in the 88th and the second goal in the 91st. And well, the rest is history. I mean, Bayern's going to be kicking themselves, right? Because this is Real Madrid, but the equalizing goal, and Manuel Neuer was fantastic, but 99 out of 100 times, he grabs that ball. I know it's easy for me to say here, but that's a one-hop ball. That's one he does in his sleep.
Yeah, and you know, at 38, he's done that a million times. Here's the thing.
That's muscle memory. It's bang, bang.
Yes, absolutely, especially for a goalkeeper of his experience and caliber. He has statistically been one of the worst goalkeepers in the Bundesliga this year. Now, those numbers are much better when you look at the Champions League. I'm looking specifically at post-shot XG compared to goals conceded. So the value of the efforts that he's faced versus how many goals he's let in. He is one of the more negative goalkeepers in the Bundesliga this season, slightly positive in Champions League play. So he's been much better in the Champions League, but that's a small sample size compared to league play, which is much larger. So he's clearly been on the decline this year. It's just such a stark juxtaposition when you look at the two saves he made in the first half, which were incredible. And then all of a sudden he makes this mistake. And, you know, everybody's saying, wow, don't count Manuel Neuer out yet. He's not dead yet. He's still going. He's 38. Holy crap. And then this happens. And it's like, well, yeah, he's also 38. Like, you know, this is just how Father Time works. No one can escape it. Father Time is has a perfect success rate. So it's just, you know, it's unfortunate to see, but there were a lot of people to blame for the Bayern collapse. He's not the only one, you know, who stands up there.
No. It happened quickly. And that's why I said, I wanted to bring Thomas Tuchel up because I was getting very smitten with him the last week after that first leg where Carlo Ancelotti said it publicly this today or yesterday that they were the better team. And there was times where Bayern were the better team. First half was kind of a push. Back end of the second half, I thought they were. There's like that 15-minute stretch where in the second half early on where Real were getting chances and you're saying, okay, this is where they're in trouble. Other than that, Bayern looked very comfortable. And while I think Real Madrid deserved the result over the 90 minutes, this was, again, not much separating the two as many people would have thought would have been the case. But we're going to talk about VAR. What do you think would have happened? So that Vinicius chance, it hit the post in the first half and the redirect came in and Neuer made the save. There was a second ball on the field. So if that ball goes in and that scored, I imagine VAR looks at that and takes it away because you can't have a second ball on the field. I don't know. I don't know how that would work out, but I think I can't imagine there would be any other outcome.
I'm going to be honest. I didn't see that. I remember that happening.
I didn't see it.
How far on the field was it?
It didn't because I didn't see it either. But when you hear about the commentary talked about it, and then there was like an overhead shot, it's pretty far off the field.
Okay.
But I just think.
I can't imagine that. That would be such a technicality to overturn a goal that I would say it would be an uproar if that actually happened.
Well,
if it,
like, we got an uproar close, anyway.
Yeah. But that was down to a mistake. Like this, that would be one of those like common sense moments where you go, let's have some common sense. There's no interference here.
I know. I hold my breath about this, but there was a good development. Well, so to speak with the goal, the first goal or the second goal to put Real Madrid in front that Jose Lu initially was called offside. And you tweeted about it, and I thought it was it's good refresher for everyone, but that's the semi-automatic Hawkeye ruling, which they didn't go to VAR. The VAR official saw it. They had the data. It said onside, and within, a minute or less, they reversed it correctly, and it didn't eat up a lot of our time. It was obviously disappointing for Bayern, but that is, you know, I've always been an opponent for VAR. I accept it and I know it's here to stay and we all want it to get better. But that was one of those aha moments. That's a moment you say, okay, this I can get along with.
So we'll dive deep into this for just a moment if you'll come with me, because I took a trip
Let's go.
Back in October to Germany and I got a tour of the Bundesliga VAR studio. And I learned a lot on that trip. And one of the things I asked about was semi-automated offside, because it hadn't at that point been confirmed for use in the Premier League or a number of other competitions. It's outlandishly expensive because you need, I believe, like 8 cameras all rigged up across the stadium so that they can triangulate. And it's a lot like goal line technology, but that's a lot less expensive. It's goal line tech is still very expensive, but it's not nearly as expensive as
Kyle, just to stop you there. There's a lot, most broadcasts around the world, not the Premier League, not the Champions League. Most broadcasts have less cameras broadcasting the game than 8 or right around 8 or 9 cameras. That is the total number of cameras, let alone what you use for replay.
Exactly. And so, it's extremely expensive, which is why it's taken so long to be instituted. But it is exceptional because when you think about watching VAR determine offside, you're literally watching the referees in real time draw lines. It's all it's super clunky. And I was in the VAR studio and watched them do this process. Like the tech guys sat down and like mocked a situation, and it took forever. Because there were so many steps. There's like 3 people communicating. They're all doing something. Because these guys weren't used to it. They were the tech guys, not the actual refs. But it took them like 5 minutes to do this. And so it's so clunky. And it's very prone to human error. All semi-automated offside. It's called semi-automated offside because there's still one human element. That human element is you need a person to find the kick point of the ball. So they literally just scrub back and forth on the replay until they find the one frame where the kick point is. And then they literally just hit go. And the computer from that camera frame triangulates the point of the ball and tells you if it's offside or not. So it's so much smoother. It's so much faster. And there's way less human error. It's just outlandishly expensive. So next season in the Premier League, you will see this in action, and it's flawless. So I'm very excited about that. And it's really, really great. It's just the reason it's taken so long is because of money.
And you'll see in the Champions League, and this is the money. You'll see in the Premier League, probably see in the World Cup, probably see in the big international competitions. But that's going to be it. I mean, to your point, these other leagues and competitions won't be able to invest in it, which is fine. I mean, this is a luxury. This is a luxury for the very top leagues to have, so we can enjoy that. But if you're watching CONCACAF Champions Cup group stages, don't freak out. You don't get the same treatment. But I think it's a great development. It was so quick and painless, which is a far cry than what we can say about the big officiating decision at the end. And Matthias De Ligt interviewed afterwards, and he said, the linesman said to me, sorry, I've made a mistake, which I love. I love the transparency. But we have talked about it, and you again off your Twitter were saying, when people get outraged, and I was one of those guys, Kyle, when you see that the late flag, because you wonder what's going to happen. Could someone get hurt on a play that was offside that is not whistled or called that? Damned if you do, damned if you don't. But here, they went against everything that we have said, or they have said, and the flag was immediate, and it was followed by the whistle from the lead official, and that took it off the table with regards to being reviewable. And a look at it, it was close. I think most people feel it was onside. De Ligt finished the play and scored the goal. Should be 2-2 heading to extra time. I mean, this is the Champions League semifinals. I think these referees are going to be, they're again, one of the best rated groups. They're going to be in a lot of hot water. I mean, this is unforgivable because it goes against the grain of everything they have said to us about the late flag. And it was such a quick flag that it brings into, I'm not saying there's a scandal involved here, but it brings that into the conversation. And people say, oh, Real Madrid, something's amok. I know that's not what happened, but I can't sit here and tell these people that would suggest as much that it had something, some foul play involved to it, because it felt that way. It was a disaster.
It was. And the crazy thing about it is, you can see why he flagged, right? Because there were two players right in there, and De Ligt was offside, but he didn't receive the ball.
Do you think he may have pulled the flag on De Ligt?
Yeah.
He thought he was going to get the ball.
Right, correct. This isn't a new rule change, right? Like, this has been around for like 7 or 8 years since they instituted VAR. This was one of the first changes they made when VAR came about. They were like, hey, hold the flag. This is down to Simon Marciniak, the head referee. And the reason is the AR can flag whenever he wants. He's supposed to keep his flag down as long as possible, just to keep one less thing for the head referee to think about, right? The head referee shouldn't have to look at the AR and go, well, hold on, let me wait to blow my whistle. He should just see the ref and then blow his whistle when the AR flags. But it is down to the head referee. He has the very simple option here of just not blowing the play dead when he sees the flag. You can clearly see three defenders and the goalkeeper stop. You can hear on the replay, it took me forever to find a replay, but I finally found it. And you can hear the whistle as Muller heads it over to De Ligt. And three defenders and the goalkeeper all stop. Lunin like watches the ball go into the net. Rudiger isn't even looking. He's looking at the official who has his flag up. There's no, you cannot review this because the official blew it dead. It's like the shot never
DOA
happened.
Yeah. Stunning. Well, it's all part of an absolutely riveting, to me, this is one of the best Champions Leagues for better or worse. From the round of 16 was dreadful. The quarterfinals were spectacular, and the semifinals were pretty darn good. And they provided so much for us to talk about. I would have hated, I was pulling for Bayern Munich because I really admired the way that they pieced it together in a year where everything fell apart for them and opened up the Bundesliga to becoming this whole new world, this brave new world where you have Leverkusen, who haven't lost in, 48 games, and Dortmund making a Champions League final, Stuttgart and Leipzig with really impressive young rosters that are going to be exciting to watch. And it's all made possible because Bayern Munich pushed out of the way. But at the end, I felt good for Bayern, and I was really pulling for Harry Kane, who's going to be criticized despite having just this, just a beautiful year. I mean, doing everything and then some for him to finally grab that ring. And it's not happening. I don't know if it's going to happen for him, but this is so close because you figure if they hang on to this lead, they beat Borussia Dortmund.
Yeah, it's tough because he had a great year. He scored a ton of goals. It's really hard to blame him for what happened. And yet, if you're being honest, he had a terrible first 45 minutes in this game. He was awful. He had a couple of chances that he really made a mess of. And he just didn't score enough Champions League goals. Like, he had a bunch of penalties, but he didn't really do it in Europe. You really do have to give credit to Bayern because they looked awful before facing Arsenal in the quarterfinal. They looked terrible. They were second best in like multiple Bundesliga games against inferior clubs. They barely dragged themselves through the group stage. It was brutal, and Tuchel pulled them up out of the dead, and he deserves a lot of credit. I don't personally think he's a great manager. He's had a number of stops where I think he's deserved criticism. He just made a mess of things at the end of his time at Chelsea, which degraded a lot faster than I think they should have. But he deserves credit for really pulling Bayern up to be a contender here. And it was tough how they went out.
We're going to take a quick break, Kyle. When we return, let's shift focus to all things USMNT. We'll talk a little bit about your conversation with Chris Richards, and we'll see what this summer is going to look like. It's going to be very exciting. It's the Soccer OG. We're in and out of the business end with Kyle Bond of the Sporting News. We are back here with Kyle Bond of the Sporting News, I figured we'd separate the champ. You know, this is where I normally do check complete, which is very appropriate because of VAR being a big factor in this. So we'll call this check complete. We're going to talk about the USMNT. Big exclusive for you getting a chance to sit with Chris Richards. I'm doing on my Soccer OG YouTube show, I'm going to rank the best seasons for American players in 2024. And I think Christian Pulisic and Weston McKennie rightfully should be 1 and 2. Number three, probably Anthony Robinson, who put up massive numbers. Sergiño Dest, we'll talk about a little bit here. I really want to put Chris Richards there at number three, not because he had the best season, Kyle, but he was tested mightily. He wasn't really in the group. They put him as a six, although he was like a center. He was like an extra center back playing a number six, which couldn't have been comfortable. Then he plays in variable positions on the back line. And now he's played what? I mean, he's played like 26, 24, 25 games, and he has become a featured player for them. He just won an award for his humanitarian work within Crystal Palace. Because of our situation at center back, which is not great right now, he is that one shining light, and he's doing wonderfully. So I want to put him at number three, and I feel good about putting him at number three because of the position and because of the path he went. You've seen him, you've spoken to him. When you think of what Chris Richards has been able to accomplish, how much has he developed in these last 3-4 months?
Yeah, I think he is developing right before our eyes. It's not been the smoothest path. It's been quite rocky. And he has risen to the occasion on every opportunity. I thought it was very telling, and I was not the first person he told this to, but he said to me and others that it was a last minute decision when he was first put at this like number six, kind of like sweeper position, if you will, because there was a player who was injured, and Roy Hodgson literally sat him down the day of the match. This was, I think, back in the winter, like January or something. And he was like, hey, you're playing at the six today. We have every confidence that you can do it. And Chris's response was, well, that makes one of us. And I mean, he literally said
that. Great answer. Great answer.
And what I thought was amazing. I mean, this is a job, a globally visible position of professional athlete where guys feel the need to have their reputation squeaky clean because everything they say, every word is picked apart. And, you know, for him to have the confidence to be like, I was terrified of this and just admit that and be like, yeah, it's a work in progress. I did not feel comfortable. This is continues to be a learning curve for me. For a young player like that is outstanding because I don't think he cares what people think of that. And that kind of honesty, I think, is very rare in the game today. And you can see it on the field. It's been messy at times. He hasn't been great sometimes, but he was immense against Manchester United. And I think you could just see the growth. Now, in that game, he was playing as part of a back three, but like still, just his play in general and that level has grown so much this year that I think that was very telling for him to be able to say, yeah, it was weird. And I wasn't comfortable. I asked him also if he got any tips from Tyler Adams and he was like, oh, absolutely not. Tyler's would never have given me because, you know, Tyler plays for another Premier League club, like their opponents, like 85% of the year. And so I was like, is that kind of an, he's like, yeah, no way Tyler would have given me pointers there.
And for the record, I mean, when you see him, because I think some of our media got a little out of control because they're saying, could we play him as the sixth of the national team? Because Tyler Adams was a plane. I'm like, wait, pump the brakes. They're not playing him as a traditional six. He's not distributing ball. He's not doing maybe the box to box stuff. He'd kind of fill gaps, which I thought, you know, when you first heard about it, you're like, wait, this is going to be a disaster. But when you saw how they used him in a very, you know, a modest way, a way where he is not stretched too much, where they could protect him. And it helped him settle into his position on the back line. And it is, it's worked out perfectly. So hats off to Crystal Palace and, you know, hanging that result on Manchester United, which you could say is the rock bottom moment for the Red Devils. I mean, I wouldn't veer against it. It was brutal. And they've hit some depths, but that might have been the bottom. I'm curious if you asked him about what is he looking to improve on? Because I see it's a really well-rounded, all-round center back. When you see him on the national team, and maybe this is just experience, you want to see him become more verbal. You want to see him, you know, get a little mean streak, which, you know, these great center backs like we saw with Anthony Rudiger and some others today, not comparing him to there, but I think there's a potential to reach a close to that kind of class of defender. But those are the kind of things I would like to see him. Where do you think he wants to see that improvement between now and the Copa and between now and the World Cup?
Yeah, I think he probably would agree that I think on the ball possessionally is probably where he needs to work on. And you can see that when he plays the six, because just like you said, he doesn't have that box to box ability because he's not a midfielder, you know, in fairness, but I think he really needs to get used to playing on the ball, especially for the U.S. national team, because they want to possess the ball. Now in Copa America, they're probably going to be playing on the counter a decent amount, especially against Uruguay. And if they meet Brazil in the knockouts, they'll play on the counter as well. But you know, against teams like Bolivia, especially, they will be playing possessionally and you'll want to see him be more comfortable on the ball. He doesn't, when he plays the six for Palace, I think the thing he needs to work on most is being influential in the game. You want a six to have possession, get touches, distribute the ball. And he just doesn't do that. Like his touch count is minuscule for a guy at defensive midfielder position. Now he's not tasked with that necessarily, but still you would like to see him be a little more influential in possession. And I think that comes with decision-making, vision, and possessional comfortability on the ball. And that can translate to his center back position as well.
I think Greg Berhalter is going to lean into him a lot because he sees him as that A number one center back, you know, Tim Ream's on the back end of it. I think the Copa America will be his last major competition. And then we have a bit of a drop off. We hope another guy comes in, but it's comforting to know that Chris Richards is there. Because if he wasn't, we'd have some serious problems. Sergiño Dest, it's devastating when you think about it, because it was about nine months of recuperation when he was having that breakthrough campaign, struggling so much to get some traction, whether it was Barcelona or Milan. And then he finds the perfect club and he's massive for them, and that he brings that over the national team, and now it is it's a big predicament. So we talk about Chris Richards as a center back. Our right back situation without Sergiño Dest is also very incomplete. And Joe Scally's there. He's earned a chance to take that job. But when we've seen him for the national team, you could see the disparity of what he certainly has not got the go forward for Sergiño Dest. He could cover up defensively a little better, but Greg Berhalter wants a guy who can get up there. So much so that you start talking about guys coming out of position. We saw Weston McKennie play there a little bit. We know Tim Weah can play it. I don't want to gloss over the fact, because I feel terrible for Sergiño, because I hate it when players work so hard and finally find it, not only get injured, but are going to miss almost a year. But unfortunately, we got to kind of look forward and start thinking how this is going to play out. And I've heard a thousand things, Kyle, from playing three in the back with wing backs, bringing four or five different types of players, whether they are a fullback or not, to that position. This is going to be the big one when it rolls around, when that roster is announced. But it's most of the questions, I think, are pretty straightforward. It's knock on wood, we don't get any more injuries. This one is wide open.
It is, and it sucks. It really sucks.
It sucks.
It sucks for Sergiño, because, like you said, he's in such good form. This was a breakout year for him after a really tough couple of years at the club level. He'd improved so much. But this has kind of been the elephant in the room for the U.S. national team for a number of years now. They were really thin at striker for a while and figured that out. But they've never really figured out both fullbacks. Look at left back. If Anthony Robinson gets hurt, there's nothing there.
You've got dire.
Lund, who's playing in, you know, the second tier in Italy. You've got a bunch of MLS guys. It's just a mess. So both fullback positions. Now, it's an improvement from years where they had no fullbacks. Now they have one at each position who are clear, you know, European stars. But it's still a mess behind them. And now Scally has not been good with the U.S. national team, and he's not been good with Gladbach this year either. He lost his starting spot for a while, and he's recently back in, but Gladbach's having a bad year overall. So they're 13th in the Bundesliga table right now, and it's just not been good for him this year. He deserves a chance and probably will get one in at least one of the two friendlies,
yeah,
and then likely Bolivia, because they play Bolivia first.
I think, I'm sorry, Carl, but I think that benefits him, because the friendlies, they're not going to rule with an iron fist. And because it's Bolivia in the opener, which I think Joe Scally will in all likelihood have a chance to showcase his skills. I tend to think that he's going to give that opportunity until you face Uruguay in game three and or Brazil or Colombia in game four or five.
Correct. But last time he got a chance was against Jamaica, and it was a disaster. That was the game that Dest was suspended for his red card, and he got yanked at halftime, and they put Weston McKennie at right back. Now, Berhalter very much sounded like that's not an option going forward, because he put McKennie there. I asked him in the post-game presser, I said, you know, why McKennie? And he was like, well, we didn't need to defend, so we just needed to attack, and that was the best option. But Scally's, he needs to take his chances, and they're not going to be many of them, because there's going to be nowhere to hide. The other options are Tyler Adams, who played right back at the very beginning of his career before being moved to the six, but he's not healthy. He's not playing for Bournemouth right now. So there's no guarantee that they can even count on him as an option. And then from there, who knows what, I think, Daywon Jones, maybe, it's just, the drop off is stark, so we'll see.
I like Daywon Jones, and he didn't get the call up for the Nations League, which suggests I don't think he's high on the pecking order as he may have been earlier. Something may not be clicking in the eyes of Greg Berhalter. You know, they mentioned Weston McKennie to me seems like a good bet, because of we don't have a deep squad, and if you move Weston McKennie, as much as you hate to do that, you have a dilemma with the midfield, right? Because you have four starting midfielders. There's room for three. You have Adams, if he's healthy. Obviously, if Adams not healthy, this changes it. McKennie, Musa, and who am I forgetting? McKennie, Musa, and Gio. And if you can find a way to get your, you know, most people say get your best 11 players, which again is not the way to approach this. You've got to have some nuance here. But in this case, maybe it makes sense because you can get Weston McKennie in there without having to bench one of the other three guys, which I think all four of them I would like to see on the field. So if I had to put a flyer out there, and I know Weah, because we don't have cover for Tim Weah as a winger. We don't. I mean,
well,
you have to bring,
yeah.
You maybe can bring Haji Ryan or someone, but it's not apples to apples. I think, to me, the more I think about it, Weston allows us the flexibility to put a better 11 out there.
So this is what's funny about this game is that when you make one move, you've got dominoes that affect all the way rest of the down the squad. You could move Weah back. That's another big option. And I would venture to guess that's the number two option behind Scally, just because you've got a guy who's playing that position at the club level. But now you've got two players who have been amazing for the U.S. out of position as a result. You've got Weah out of position. He's far and away the best right wing option. And then you've got to move Gio out wide to the right. And he's been amazing at the eight. So you could put, like you said, Haji Wright on the wing. But I think Haji Wright's in a position where he's the starting number nine. I don't think Balogun has done enough to be the starting striker versus Haji. Haji is scoring goals for club and country, and Balogun's doing neither. And I think Balogun's the better player, but I think Haji's just earned it at this point. Balogun has not done enough. And at Copa, that makes a difference. I think you take the long-term approach with Balogun, but right now Haji writes the starting number nine. So now if you put Haji out wide, now you've got a hole at nine, and you got to put Balogun in there. So it's just a mess. You know, you've got to move guys all over the place, and you don't want to be moving too many players out of position.
Again, so I think maybe Haji can... This is going down the rabbit hole. It's let's wrap things up with the number nine, because it used to be a big issue. It still is an issue, but it used to be an issue because we didn't have anyone there. We couldn't play anyone, but we have four really good, maybe five, if we want to include Brandon Vasquez. Let's just say four good candidates there three that have really earned it. Haji Wright, Josh Sargent, Ricardo Pepi to a lesser degree. He's playing with PSV. He's played Champions League. I love what he's been able to do. Flo Balogun hasn't really earned it with his play, but the fact that he swore allegiance to the United States, I think, and maybe that window's closing a bit, but I truly believe that there is an agreement in place because you're going to be the number nine for the time being. But I think that they're saying, okay, we've got to make a decision here because you're not playing at the level we had hoped for. I know you probably feel the same way. And I have heard it from everyone. I've seen people stay Balogun. I would tend to think to stick with Balogun because I beat myself to death, beat my head against a table here, hoping that eventually it'll click into place. But Haji Wright makes sense. Josh Sargent didn't play wasn't on the Nations League, I think makes sense too. And I'm hearing a lot about him maybe moving up the pecking order because a lot of people say he is the most talented number nine. I'm not going to argue that either. But this is... Look, the whole thing with Greg Berhalter, we want as few dilemmas as possible. But right now, I think there's two, potentially three or four that we'd like to alleviate. But so you think Haji Wright should go there? Or how could you play with it a little bit to make room for another winger if, in fact, Weah drops back?
So the only thing with Haji is that he plays left wing for his club. Now, he's basically an inside or second striker. They essentially shove him into the middle and then bomb the fullback. But he's technically a left winger for the club. But when he comes in as a nine for the U.S., he has delivered. And Balogun hasn't. You kind of jumped me here because I thought I was going to be all sensational and say that I think Sargent should be above Balogun in the pecking order too.
But not above Haji.
No. I think it right now for me, the depth chart is Haji, Sargent, Balogun. I think
it's probably accurate.
Yeah, I think all three should make the Copa roster, mostly because of positional flexibility. Now, Sargent has been way worse on the wing than he has it at the nine for club and country. He can play out wide, but he just hasn't done it. Haji can. Problem is he's kind of a left winger rather than right. You can play him on the right, but he's more of a left winger. I think Brandon Vasquez also kind of has put his name in the mix, as you mentioned, but there's just too many guys. And Vasquez can play on the wing too. So can Pepi, but there's just too many to pick. Somebody's got to get left off. I think you bring those three, which is already a lot. Sometimes you can only bring two. I think you bring those three and figure it out. But I think Balogun's third out of those three. Sargent is scoring goals and good goals.
It is. It's crazy to think about it. I can't really argue that. And it's like put up or shut up time here as we've reached it. This is Greg Berhalter's legacy. This, he needs to really deliver here. The pressure is on.
And I want to say this too. This is coming from somebody who has backed Balogun as a starting striker for a while. I still think he's got it. Like I said, I think you take the long-term approach with him. Right. He's still the guy. But right now, you got to go with who's scoring goals. And I think a lot of the issues with Balogun are they're just not finding him. He's making the runs, and Berhalter has said that repeatedly in press conferences. He's like, he's doing it. We're not giving him the ball. We're not finding him in the moments where he's the best. But you've got to leave that for the next 2 years. Right now, you go with the guys who are scoring goals.
I love it. I actually really I love that approach. And you say you kill them with positivity. We have the World Cup. We have all this ahead of us. But this tournament is in a few weeks. We need to go with the hot hand. I think when Haji started the game against Mexico, jumping ahead of Ricardo Pepi, I think that was telling to show the pecking order of how high Haji has risen. I think Greg Berhalter is very, very confident with him going back to the World Cup and getting him some minutes, particularly in the Dutch game late. And Josh Sargent, we just don't know because he didn't get on the Nations League, pulled out because of injury. But I get the feeling that Greg is confident with him as well. So there's going to be some tough conversations, but I would not be surprised if that is the way it looks, in particular with Haji Wright, who it's a reason to celebrate. A guy who's on the outside, figured it out, traveled to so many interesting ports of call to find games, find goals, and he's done it. He almost should have been in an FA Cup final, for crying out loud.
Yeah, and what's cool about Haji is I don't think many people know, I didn't know until recently, that he was actually a really, really top prospect when he was at the youth level.
Yep.
They had high hopes for him. And that was at a time just kind of before, you know, we've really got the attention on the U.S. youth team that we do now. I think he's 27 or 28 now. But, you know, he was a top prospect, and it didn't work out. It wasn't working. And to see it finally come to fruition and finally develop is really cool.
That's awesome. Didn't get discouraged. And it's so easy to do that. I talk to guys when they're 24, 25, they feel the writing's on the wall and they say, okay, I'm going to put to bed the international hopes because it's a young man's game. So wonderful. And I pull for him a lot, Kyle. He's an LA kid. We've got to look out for our LA kids. Kyle Bond of the Sporting News. Dude, we covered a lot of ground.
We went through it, man. It's fun. I love being in the middle of this stuff. This is the time of year.
You can tell.
Thank you.
You can tell. And enjoy it because it's going to be here. We're going to have the Champions League final. We're going to wrap up the leagues, and then we're going to have the Euros and the Copa in our face. Get some Z's. Get your rest. Get your cardio. Eat your salads. I don't know. Do what I told this to everyone. I'm so excited, but my heart races because I'm terrified about the amount of soccer we're going to watch because this is pretty unprecedented.
Terrified? My man, there is no such thing. We're not the runs running around on the field.
Listen,
Kyle, if that was the case, look out.
I'm a 7-8 hour sleep guy. There's no way I'm going to be able to keep 7 or 8 hours. If I can get 5 a night, I will be doing backflips, but that might even be a push. I'm just going to say I'm not going to be looking as good as I look now. I got the fluids in, I got in, I got a little sun on my face. Sun, forget about it for June and July.
Yeah, you're right. We're going to be through the ringer, that's for sure.
We'll touch base with that. I appreciate you joining us here on the Soccer OG. Kyle, you were fantastic. We'll talk very soon.
Anytime, my man. Thank you for having me.
Check out Kyle Bond, B-O-N-N, who works for the Sporting News. Follow him on social media. He will steer you the right direction. That's all the time we have for the Soccer OG. As always, rate, review, download, subscribe, tell a friend. And let us know about our little podcast. And we'll be back again next week. More great guests, more great topics. We are on the Autobahn now, going full throttle. Until we meet again, Placido Domingo.